So, this modelling approach, have you done it anywhere else, Chris? Have you, you know, successfully predicted other elections using sort of a similar sort of setup?
I don't know about successfully. So Nick, my co-author on this, had some experience in 2010, and he covered his ass wonderfully well, because he and Simon Hicks produced three different projections based on three different variants of national swing. And one of those did really well.
That's what he talks about. The one that had the strongest mean revision to Labour's 2005 vote share, right? Yeah.
So Nick has some experience. I tried to forecast the 2013 Italian election. And that was tough. It was tough for two reasons. First, the Italian party system is notoriously fluid.
Yes.
So even when you're applying some kind of uniform national swing, you have to check that the swings are between the same sets of parties as were competing in the two elections.
Yes.
So there were problems posed by the party system, but the other problem was the embargo on the publication of polls in the last 14 days before the election. Now, this is a really long embargo period. I'm not aware of any longer embargo period in the world, but this embargo period has meant that Italian polling is generally pretty bad for reasons that are unsure, because not enough people are commissioning polls in the last couple of days where we could detect some opinion change if it existed. So if you look at the 2013 polling postmortems, it's not really clear why the polling industry was off, not spotting the rise of the five-star movement, why it overestimated the main party of the centre-left. It's not clear whether that's because of a late change in voter opinion or just polling that was off and was always off throughout the course of the campaign.
And I suppose, like, without them to be too cynical, you almost have an incentive, you have less of an incentive to be accurate if you've always got everything changed in the last 2 weeks as a sort of an excuse, right?
Yeah, and sometimes that might even be true.
Yeah, but you just don't know.
Exactly.
So it's sort of deeply frustrating for the political scientist. But so what's happened in Italy since then? I mean, my perception is that everyone was very excited by the five-star movement. It was big news, perhaps not least because it was seen as a big, dramatic breakthrough. How have they fared since then?
So there are certain parallels between the 2013 Italian election and the forecast result for the UK, in that it seemed like this party, which didn't have any coalition potential, had surged, and it was going to make the process of government formation really difficult. And I remember being at a post-election workshop in Florence, and lots of people were saying, there's no way that the parliamentary arithmetic works. You're never going to get a grand coalition, because the five-star movement would be able to use a coalition of the main left and right-wing parties to say, oh, look, these typical politicians, they're all the same, they're in it together. So people were saying, no grand coalition, second election. What happened? Grand coalition. And we're still going, and the government plans to go through to 2018 and the next regularly scheduled parliamentary elections.
Which, of course, hasn't always been quite like that. I mean, there's sort of an old polling joke about you don't ask who's going to win the next election, you ask when it's going to be. But it looks like the government's pretty stable. And how's that panning out? I mean, so that's between Berlusconi's party, Forza Italia, and the Democrats, which is led by Renzi. Is that...
Yeah, I mean, Renzi is without a doubt the key protagonist in Italian politics at the moment, and dominates the scene to a degree that is difficult certainly for people who've followed Italian politics and have been used to the dominance of Berlusconi. It's difficult for us now to understand that there's someone with there's a new big swinging dick on the scene. If you'll forgive me the language.
Make sure this is after the watershed.
I think the successor to that title from Berlusconi might be wary of that accolade. But yeah,
I mean, the slightly more family friendly nickname for Renzi is the bulldozer, because he made a name for himself saying that he was going to be a new broom to sweep away some of the older politicians on the centre left who were decent, worthy people, but on occasion irredeemably boring. So he has bulldozed his way through a number of things. The record on the economy is not great, but they are pushing through electoral reform and constitutional reform, and he's kept to some of the promises and the timetables that he set out at the beginning.
And so there, the Democrats are up on where the, on the last election, give or take. So what's happened to the five-star movement? Are they slipping off, or are they staying pretty consistent in the polling?
They've tailed away. I mean, they've had a problem with this vast new cohort of parliamentarians who weren't really bound by any coherent ideology and who've just started fighting between themselves.
Right.
So their support has slipped away, and the Democratic Party has done astoundingly well, most notably in the 2014 European Parliament elections, where the left reached its highest vote share ever.
Right. Gosh.
So they're doing really well, and the five-star movement is still relevant, but it's now not as much of a troublemaker as it was. I mean, they still cause problems for the other parties, but it's they're trying to be ignored by the other parties.
And then are there any other trends going on in terms of, you know, we've seen in other places, times of economic challenge and so on, you know, the far right doing particularly well. Is that a phenomenon that's happening in Italy as well?
I would be careful about imposing any directionality on it. I mean, there's some very good scholar of the extreme right wing in Europe, Cass Mudd, who's been very careful to dismantle this idea that economic problems inevitably lead to a surge in radical right-wing populism. I think it's true that economic problems create a mood for change. That can sometimes mean change from the left, sometimes change for the right. It's true in Italy that the Northern League, which has always based its appeal on a territorial claim, a kind of secessionist movement, is now trying to branch out and become much more of a national movement.
Right.
And try and claim this radical right-wing mantle. Mm. Not clear how successful that will be, but it's interesting that they're trying. They evidently see some space opening up for them.
Interesting. So, I mean, to that end, Kieran, I mean, is Italian politics similar to other movements that are going on? I mean, do you see parallels with Greece or perhaps with, you know, domestic politics in the UK in terms of UKIP, in terms of some of the implications that that has?
I'd always be careful about saying, because this has happened here, that reflects what's happening in X, Y and Z. But, you know, I think I'd echo what Chris says there. But it is interesting in these turbulent times that we have. You see Greece as that shockwave is running through Europe at the moment with the election of a new government there. How successful they're going to be in terms of what they want to actually achieve is another matter. But that's going to be very interesting and has the potential to impact on what goes on here in the May election. If something particularly catastrophic happens within Europe between now and May, it stands to reason that UKIP will try and profit on that. That's going to put pressure on the Prime Minister, maybe gives Ed Miliband a boon because he can say, well, look, you know, we don't want uncertainty now, we want to stay in the European Union and so on. So what goes on in Europe can affect us. I mean, I'm interested in, you know, specifically the UK, though, because we've often thought that quote-unquote radical politics won't happen here. It's, you know, the far right, for example, has always been something that is in Europe, but it doesn't happen here. And maybe to an extent that's true when we see the lack of success that the BNP have had over the years. But there's definitely something going on. And I think it depends on how kind you want to be to UKIP and the SNP when you look at that. I mean, I wouldn't for a second say the SNP is a far right party, but there's something about the sort of populist nature of what's going on there and the radical nature of what's going on there with the SNP and UKIP that is interesting. And I think under the surface, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a dominant view, but under the surface there can be something quite unpleasant at the grassroots of the SNP when you look at some of the scenes in Glasgow after the night of the referendum, some of the anti-English sentiment, some of that sectarianism that we know exists sort of boiling to the surface. Whether or not that's direct, you know, there are Scottish-specific elements to why that's going on, but it's interesting that after all the turbulence that we've had in the last 5 years, and obviously with the referendum specifically, that that's going on. And then when we look at UKIP, it's much easier, I think, to make an argument for their radicalism. I mean, you know...
But is it? I mean, I often think that actually the parallel with Italian politics for UKIP could arguably be the five-star movement, right? Run by a clown, you know, sort of anti-politics as usual kind of mood, you know. I think there's... But that, I mean, to Chris's point, that idea that, you know, economic uncertainty breeds a desire for change. You know, we've seen anti-politics kind of parties. And in some ways, UKIP, I think, are most successful when they're unencumbered by ideological baggage, and it's much more about a rejection of politics of usual and so on. I mean, to that point, is Beppe Grillo funny? I mean, what kind of brand of
Beppe Grillo hasn't been funny since the 80s.
Right, because I've always wondered, like, is he a sort of, you know, a radical kind of Mark Thomas kind of agitprop kind of comic, or is he more a kind of Chris Tarrant kind of easygoing kind of, you know, sort of talk show host type?
Oh, he's much more agitprop, right. Certainly.
Right.
I just don't find him particularly funny. He's built... he's done very well by painting himself as a martyr.
Right.
So in the 80s... It was clear that he was not going to be invited onto the main public broadcaster,
right?
And this became a big thing for him because suddenly he could bill himself as, you know, the guy that
the establishment,
powers that be, the establishment, and it's like I Poteri Forti didn't want on the screens, so he was able to parlay that into a particular kind of niche appeal, and so that there's a sense of victimhood for him, and that sense of victimhood sometimes in politics works quite well.
Yeah, I mean, arguably Farage lots of the time portrays himself as a victim. You know, the SNP, there's a certain sense of victimhood about, you know, getting a bad deal despite what, you know, colleagues in Wales might think about their you know, the Barnett formula and so on that we talked about with Roger Scully. Right, well, that's been a fascinating conversation about everything from, you know, the coastal towns to the Northern League. Perhaps we should finish off in customary fashion. We haven't done this for a little while, but to bring it back. So, poll finding of the week. Kieran, what have you been reading?
Well, one of the interesting things I've been following in the last couple of days is Natalie Bennett's interview with LBC, which I think it's safe to say didn't go down particularly well. I mean, you know, without being too unkind, it was really, really difficult to listen to. But the interesting debate that follows from that is how much does it actually matter? And one of the poll findings that I've seen in the past few days, which granted was actually taken before the interview, although I don't think it would be dramatically affected by it, was by Servation for the Mirror. And I think I'm right in saying it had 37% didn't even know who she was. Now, the obvious implication there being that actually, do you know what, it's hard for the Greens to tank as a result of that interview when no one actually knows who she is anyway, let alone listened to the interview.
No such thing as bad publicity.
Well, I suppose is a separate issue. I mean, I would take some exception with some of the people that you've seen on social media saying that actually this is probably a good thing for her because it shows that she's human and that she's not of Westminster and that sort of thing. It's, I mean, you know, you'd like to think that people are prepared for interviews if they're leading a political party and, you know, if they're going to say Labour are wrong and not really left-wing enough and we're going to do things properly. It'd be good if you sort of had your sums sort of added up. But, you know, it is interesting, this age-old thing about polling and politics, and anyone that engages with it, is that we always have to remember that the public as a whole don't pay anywhere near as much attention to it as we do. And this is just another example of that.
It's interesting. I mean, I think you're right in terms of, I doubt it's a good thing. I mean, I think she handled the aftermath quite well in terms of saying, look, I'm really sorry and I want to apologise to the activists and the people in my party. I didn't have a good day and all the rest of it. But I think the interesting thing there is, I mean, we often talk about valence in politics, but actually, if Cameron or Miliband had that kind of interview, I think it would have been fairly catastrophic for their ratings. Whereas actually, most people, I would imagine, who are voting Green, you know, this goes back to our conversation about protest votes and the Five Star Movement and Syriza in Greece and so on. What's interesting about Syriza in Greece is they're actually in power now, and so they're having to be challenged by some of those questions which they previously weren't going to. I think with the best will in the world, nobody really thinks that, certainly at the next election, the Green Party can be in a situation where they're going to have to be putting these policies to the test. So the reason for voting for them is quite different.
Absolutely. I mean, you're electing a Prime Minister if you're voting for Labour or the Conservatives, and frankly, for everybody else, you're not necessarily. But it could give some credence to Labour's argument that a vote for the Greens is a wasted vote. I mean, ultimately, whenever you're trying to, if you're a major party and you're trying to tackle an insurgent that's mopping up your base, to use a phrase, the best way to do that is to try and say, look, that's a wasted vote, you're going to let the other side that you hate even more win. They're not credible, they can promise you anything they want, but actually it's not deliverable. All of those arguments are going to be what Labour are going to try and say about, you know, the Greens or about others. So it's same with the Conservatives and UKIP maybe, on Europe and issues of that nature. So this sort of thing could hurt the Greens in that regard, but, you know, whether or not it actually cuts through, we don't know.
So, because I know that you did some work on you know, where the Green vote's coming from and which seats to sort of look out for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Greens could be the margin of difference between a Labour defeat and Labour victory in about six or seven seats. I think it's interesting to think about Labour's strategy and the way that they communicate the idea that the Greens are a wasted vote, because it seems, to me at least, that one way of communicating that the Greens are a wasted vote is by ignoring them, you know, just not talking about them at all. Because if you try and fight them, then they get defensive and they say, look, these big meanies are picking on us. And so if you just ignore them and just try and deprive them of the oxygen of publicity, they might go away. We'll see whether that's in fact the strategy they pursue and whether indeed it's the right strategy.
So so what about you, Chris? What have you seen this week that or perhaps over the last few weeks that's interesting and struck you?
So my surprising poll or data finding relates to those economic conditions that we were talking about before.
Right.
And in particular, the surprising lack of link between objective economic conditions and what people think has happened.
Right.
So I was starting from a question about people's economic evaluations over the past year, as the economic situation of your household over the past 12 months got very much better, somewhat better, that kind of question. And I wanted to match that up with the data that I had on earnings at the constituency level and see whether there was any association. Turns out there's no real association there at all.
Right.
And the earnings can go up in a constituency without people saying that their own household economic situation has improved in any way. Actually, what seems to be happening is that when you ask people a question about change in their economic conditions, they actually give an answer that's based on how well off they are, their level. So people
right.
who are well off
say things are going well and getting better.
Things have improved.
Yeah.
Things who are people who are poorer off say things have got worse, even if there's been very little change there. So that I'm not sure I have that story straight.
Mm.
Certainly I don't have anything that I'd want to publish in an academic journal, but it struck me as interesting the way that, as Kieran's already said, there's a science here and there's the art of asking questions and interpreting answers.
Yeah, but also has big implications for this. I mean, people argue that Osborne's great sort of next trick is to get the economy ticking along at just the right rate is that in the run-up to the election, and that sort of rising tide will carry the Tories back to office. Whereas actually, even if things are improving sort of objectively in terms of GDP or earnings per hour or whatever else it is, whether or not that's the media narrative or whether actually it's their absolute situation and this inequality and so on, which perhaps isn't going to be shifting, that people aren't picking up on that. And that's going to pay out in lots of different constituencies as well. We were talking about, I think a couple of weeks ago, about fuel prices. Inside London, relatively smaller impact if you're looking at some of those marginal constituencies. Whole space of the country where, let's face it, journalists who are writing political stories don't live, much, much bigger issue. And so you've got some interesting dynamics there. My poll finding of the week, 60% thinking it's a time for a change of government versus 34%, so just over half of those, who think they need to stay the course with this government. That 34% looking fairly suspiciously like the Conservative vote share on average this week. And then just, which is interesting, not least because of, the Lib Dems and so on. And then just 25% thinking Ed Miliband would make a good Prime Minister versus 61% who think he would make a bad Prime Minister. 25% thinking Ed Miliband would be a good Prime Minister, obviously being significantly lower than the Labour vote share of, give or take 35% that we've seen. And I just think that those four numbers, actually, sort of from two questions, sum up very neatly the election that we're actually facing. You've got a classic contest between, as you were saying earlier, to stay the course with the current government, don't change things, things are on the improvement, or we need a big change, where change is clearly the order of the day. 60% saying that we need a change is, similar to Barack Obama in, 2008 kind of figures. That's really quite a fierce rejection of the status quo. But then that obviously being the Labour argument that, that will give them great solace. 60% thinking it's a time for change. They only need to pick up 2/3 of those to have a majority, which I think we all think is unlikely, but, it's an interesting piece. But then obviously the Conservatives wanting to make this a referendum about Ed Miliband and, hoping that stay the course figure plus the rejection of Ed Miliband that you were saying earlier. So I think looking at how those two numbers gives quite a good sense of how the dynamic's playing out. There's a great West Wing episode where they say that the battle is not over, how people are going to vote, but the question itself. And I think, for me, those two questions summarise up where this election stands quite neatly. All that's left for me is to thank both of my guests, Chris and Dr. Chris Hanratty from the University of East Anglia and Kieran Pedley. And the music that you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under a Creative Commons.